Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the NIDS View, a production of the NIDS Podcasting Network, keeping you informed about the importance of deterrence in this new year and beyond. I'm Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, and today we're conducting part two, further discussing our recent NIDS research insight, establishing a proposed nuclear posture review. And for those that need a reminder, just go to nids@thinkdeterrence.com and you can find the NIDS proposed posture review, Peace Through Strength, Renewing America's Nuclear Deterrent, which is what we'll be talking about today. Along, by the way, if you go out there, there's a plethora. I think I wanted to use the word plethora today.
And
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, anthropomorphism and plethora are the two words you got to get into every really important talk. Okay, but a plethora of other deterrence-related materials, seminar links, podcasts, and even really nice pictures of our members, staff, and experts. And I'm joined today by no other than Curtis McGiffin. Hey, Curtis, how you doing today?
Hey, Jim, good to see you.
Hey, you know, I was thinking about it when we were recording before, and I've been looking at the video. So we'll have to ask other people to think. I know when we came in, Kimberly made a comment that we both were dressed similarly. And I agree, I'm wearing a burgundy shirt with a jacket. But as I look, I just realized just before the show started that you look like you're wearing a Star Trek Next Generation captain's uniform. So, you know, if you put on one of those little, you know, tap it and talk, you'd be one of the Star Trek people. So there you go. That's what you're wearing.
Make it so, number one, and don't step in number two.
There you go.
This is my classic Fetterman. I really enjoy the hoodie while doing respectable and responsible things. It's named after the senator from Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
And who always wears hoodies.
Okay.
So you know, it's chilly here. It's a post Christmas time. It's still
still winter.
Sort of relaxed, still winter.
Got it.
So I thought I would bring out my my bicolored Fetterman.
All right. Well, very good. Well, as part two, what we want to do is dig in a little bit deeper into the specifics of the proposed NPR for those that hadn't read it, and talk about some of the implications of it, especially with, you know, given the national security strategy came out, and some testimony that we discussed last time. But before we get back to it, Curtis, I want you to go back through your laundry list of things that were related on the NPR.
Well,
because you created, and by the way, none of these things start with P. Maybe planned production would be a P, but normally you do give us a five P.
There's no four P's for this one now.
Okay.
this is part two. If you haven't listened to part one, please stop here. Go back to part one and listen to that first. But in any case, we started part one referring to a recent early on December 10th, testimony of Ambassador Marshall Billingsley and Ambassador Rose Gottmiller, who testified before the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee on some various items regarding New START Treaty and some of these other things here. And in the Ambassador Billingsley's testimony, he read a list to the senators of the things that he believed he said, with urgency, we need to do the following things. And I wanted to remind our listeners what those were. And so, again, according to Ambassador Billingsley, although, Jim, quite frankly, you or I could have read this, could have invented this same list, but here it is, right? So he says, first, well, I guess in no apparent order here, but anyway, he said, we have to prepare to upload some or all of our nation's hedge warheads. This would be the stockpile warheads, which I want to talk to you about a little later in our broadcast today. We need to plan to deploy the Sentinel ICBM in a MIRVed configuration. This would be multiple warheads on a single missile. We need to increase the planned number of deployed long-range standoff weapons. This is the new nuclear cruise missile that is more stealthier and is going to be designed for use on the, of course, on the B-52 and the new B-21. We need to increase the planned number of B-21 bombers. I presume this is beyond the 100 that are planned in the program of record. The ambassador did not give a number that he desired. Increase planned production of the Columbia SSBN submarine with their Trident ballistic missile systems. Again, he doesn't ask for more. How many more? He just says we need to increase the planned production, which right now I believe is 12. And then he says we need to look at fielding a Rhode Mobile ICBM. We need to prepare to put a portion of the future bomber fleet on continuous alert status. He says we need to develop plans and procedures to reconvert the SLBM launchers and B-52 bombers that were rendered incapable of launching a nuclear weapon under New START. I believe, Jim, that the 2025 NDAA called for the B-52s to all be renuked, if you will, or some variation of that. And then finally, he notes, be prepared to keep operating the Ohio-class SSBNs past their currently planned retirement dates. I would presume that is not only to overcome any delays in the Columbia production, but maybe to augment and plus up the SSBN numbers for a few another decade, maybe until you know things get calmed down, or you know, more Columbias could be built, or whatever the case may be. Anyway, and the reason why that list is important is because he testified that to the Senate in December 10th of 2025, but all of those things are talked about in our NPR, which was published in early November. And so I think about a month prior to this. So it's possible that the ambassador read our NPR, though I don't know that.
You know, Curtis, though, for our audience sake, if you go out and pull up the NPR at thinktheturns.com and look at our research insights, just to amplify what Curtis is saying, go to page 25 and read to about page 34, I believe. So if you're not into reading the whole thing, so up the page, actually beyond there, because we're going to talk a little bit about the edge. Yeah, 34. I was right. Wow. I can't believe I read it that well. And remember, I pulled it up while I was talking about it. Catch up here. So there we go. So that's almost everything that Curtis just talked about fits into those pages alone. So yeah. Apocryphal. So, okay.
I think so. We're prescient. I would say this. So the first thing he brings up is warheads out of the hedge and putting them back on, presumably the Minuteman III, remerving the Minuteman III, which we call for in the NPR. Prior to that list, he testified to the Senate the following, and I'm going to quote from his transcript. I'm interested in your comments. I think our listeners are as well, Jim. So let me read this to you here. Quote, Russia keeps its warhead stockpile in a constant state of refurbishment and readiness, whereas many of the warheads in our hedge are not operationally available, in various stages of disassembly, and or lacking associated delivery systems. In short, Russia's warhead stockpile is growing while ours is shrinking. Unquote. I'm interested in your thoughts on that. That was a bit of new information for me, to sort of insight as to how Russia is maintaining its stockpile. At least he believes, from his learned perspective, and versus how we might be keeping our stockpile, is to me all very interesting. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So Curtis, first of all, it's no big secret that we took our finger off the pulse back in 1992. Nothing wrong with us moving to a stockpile stewardship program in terms of what we did. We stopped testing in terms of explosive testing, and we started looking at the stockpile from a scientific analysis standpoint. I'm going to get to your answer here. It's like a little bit convoluted here, because in that process, what we did, though, is we learned a lot about our weapons, but what we didn't do is we didn't start modernizing them. We started learning about them without the modernization in terms of upgrading systems, etc. You always talk about we're only a few years into a 35-year modernization or 65.
We're 15 years into a 30-year modernization.
I have to use the Curtis quote. Thank you, Curtis. Yeah, so we're 15 years into a 30-year or plus modernization. And what the Russians did when we took our finger off the pulse is they just kept going. And they continued to modernize their weapons as they learned. And we started late. And now we're behind. So that's the first piece. Now, we talk about the hedge, because what they did with their hedge, by the way, you know, the treaty is about strategically deployed weapons. You know, this has nothing to do with tactical weapons or anything in the hedge. It just has to do with what is out there strategically deployed. But how far behind you are. And I'm not going to pretend to know there's so many days or so many months or so many other pieces. And even if I did, I probably would not discuss that on this podcast. But I will say it takes time to bring those weapons out of whatever storage they are, rematch them if they're not matched on a warhead. Remember, the nuclear component to it and the non-nuclear component are two separate parts of the weapon, and they have to be matched together. And then, of course, they have to be matched to a deployment system. And we've changed those, for example, and as we modernize, and they have to be done coherently. And so we're behind on that. I mean, we even announced that we were there, I think, as part of the 2008-2009, we're going through Schlesinger report saying, we haven't played with these. We've taken our finger off the thought of nuclear. We've taken our finger off the deployment of nuclear. We've taken off all these pieces. And now we have lost, 10 years, 15 years of understanding and developing of these weapons where the Russians didn't, and it put us behind. And I believe that's what we're talking about here. Now, to those systems themselves are taken out of the stockpile. We've got to come out. We've got to come up with a better methodology for maintaining them. One, to keep the weapons ready, but two, to keep the skills and the knowledge that people have in terms of reassembling, components, reassembling, placing them on delivery systems, matching those delivery systems with all the great safety and security requirements that are there. You have to rebuild that capability. And that's what puts the Russians ahead of us, because they've been doing this for 15, 20 years, and we've been waiting. So it's not the modernization piece that's harming us. It's the fact that we've not been doing any, we've been learning, but not implementing.
Let me correct you here. I think we've, over the 15 years, we've been hoping.
Well,
not waiting. We've been hoping that that the Russians will see the light and stop doing this. Well, when you look at any of the numbers that come from the disarmament community, you always hear the Russians have 5,600 warheads, yeah. The Americans have 5,500 warheads. They never take into account the status of that hedge. And the reality is, at least according to this testimony, right? Well, I understand that, but I'm talking about warhead maintenance and warhead possession. Mm-hmm. And when theirs are in various stages of modernization and storage, active storage, and ours are in various stages of disassembly and retirement, hundreds and hundreds of warheads were retired over the Biden administration, for sure. And the active stockpile versus the inactive stockpile is greatly different. And I don't know what it takes to make an inactive weapon an active weapon again. You do, I don't, and we may not be able to talk about that today. No. But the point is, it takes a great amount of effort, and I'm sure, and expense, because once you disassemble obliterate the weapon, right? You disassemble it to the point where it can never be put back together again. Then the only option you have is to build a new weapon, and that's a challenge, I think, as our infrastructure is struggling to get to that point. I know we're making great way. We had a great speaker in a HUSI event here recently, and NSA is doing valiant work and building new pits and so forth.
But we're still behind.
But we are behind.
That's right. That's the point.
We need a Manhattan plan, a Manhattan Project like effort in order to get where we need to be, not where we should be. That's those are two different two different numbers. It may not be possible. Perhaps we should outsource the warheads.
I'm not sure we want to do that.
It's a flippant joke, yes, but what I'm saying is we need to help if we can't do it ourselves.
But Curtis, permit me to provide an analogy.
Sure.
So my daughter has a car, and she drives it, and eventually the tires get bald and it starts to misfire. She's got an 8-cylinder and maybe 5 of them work. And then, and what ended up happening with her, the car that she had, is she just kept putting it off. And finally, she wants to try to upgrade her car. The problem is that some of the components that are made for this older car are not made the same way anymore. She has to go out and find second pieces, right, et cetera. And this is where we are in the development of our weapons. We had specialized companies making components for our weapons. This is part of the modernization and why it's so important that we have to modernize, because we're not going to go back to some semiconductor company and say, make these 3 piece parts again, or these, 100 of these piece parts again, the way we used to make them in an assembly line. It doesn't exist anymore, with components and people that don't know how to do it anymore, and start from scratch. Whereas the Russians, what they did behind the scenes, and you want to call it hope, I really truly believe, beyond a hope, I wonder if this is some sort of intelligence failure, that we really miss this. I mean, I just can't believe that we are naive enough to just say, sure, they're doing it, we're not looking. I just think it's a failure, or, really good Russian, counterintelligence, whatever. But it happened without us thinking, what if? What if, while we're sitting here letting the tires go bald, letting the spark plugs go bad, letting electronics on the dashboard go bad, while we're doing that, the companies that were making them aren't making them anymore. And now we go, how do you start that? Well, you're right. The Manhattan Project, we did it in 4 years. But remember, the weapon systems we have today are much more complex because of safety and security. And I absolutely agree that you would not have taken that first weapon, and you can read stories about it. I'm not going to confirm or deny some of the stories that are said about those weapons, but safety and security were not quite where we are today. And that is important, that we have that ability. Plus, we're connecting those weapons. Again, we go back and look at the safety requirement, where you had to have someone climb inside and yank a metal chain out of the nuclear weapon while it's flying along, and stick the pit together while it's in process. We're not doing it anymore. It's much more complex, much smarter. We certainly can't do that on a missile. It's flying in space, unless Curtis decides he's going to go ahead and fly into space like the guy on that movie that I've still never watched, sitting on the missile system. What's the name of that movie?
Are you talking about Dr. Strangelove, where he falls out on the bomb?
Yeah,
he's on a bomb out of the bomber.
Yeah, whatever. So
Slim Pickens, he's going down like a rodeo clown.
But our systems are so complex. Our aircraft are so well designed that we're able to bring that weapon on board, test and evaluate it, make sure it's going to work when it goes up, so we don't risk that. Those are all good things, but we didn't keep up. So now you're taking these, 40-year-old spark plugs and trying to plug them into a new system, or a fuel injection system, onto a car carburetor, onto a fuel injection system. They don't work anymore. And so so we are in that position. So I am exactly on board with reestablishing this. This is the important piece for our audience. We have to rethink how we're going to manage our hedge, how we're going to manage the technologies. We don't know what technology is coming out in 2026, 2027. AI is out there. New design come out there. New processes come out there. New materials are being developed. We have to stay on board. This should be a history lesson for every person in government that looks at deterrence, should look back and say, this history lesson that we learned since 1992 cannot be repeated, because it put us in a position where we could be vulnerable, and we don't want to be there. And thank goodness deterrence has not failed, because I don't want to go from deterrence to defense. Because when we go to defense, we better have stuff on board to be able to make that defense work. I'd rather not get there. And I think that's where you're talking about in this hedge strategy, going from a deterrence structure to a defense structure. We don't want to go there. And by the way, while I was talking, in addition to that, I was looking at your bullet list on page 34, and you can go over to the with urgency on page 3 of the testimony. I do think someone read our NPR, and if they didn't, they should have. Go ahead.
Well, let me say, I think, look, arming for defense is different than arming for deterrence. That's a whole nother podcast to have and an article I have yet to write. But let me, and this NPR really discusses about arming for deterrence, but you must also be prepared. Mm-hmm. Should deterrence fail, that you can then utilize the systems to defend. And we're not going to get into all the different, you know, ways and whys and hows that can be, but you've got to have systems that work, right? And we note here in the beginning of this, in the guidance to the force, that credibility is born of five efforts, right? You have to have a credible force, right? And the first is America's reputation to maintain resolve. And its global influence and its warrior ethos, right? The second is America's investment in and timely acquisition of powerful capabilities and capacities that are consequential, not just sufficient.
Ah, bingo.
Right? That's so the words are different. The words mean things here. Next, the third one is the readiness, all right, and ability of America's nuclear arsenal to respond and retaliate to threats or attacks promptly and effectively. This is where the alert force comes in. Mm-hmm. Maybe not continuing with a launch under attack scenario, these sorts of things.
Maybe bombers on alert.
Right. The fourth is survivability of the American nuclear arsenal and its ability to endure any first strike. This would be why the ambassador is calling for more submarines and perhaps mobile ICBMs and, of course, more bombers on alert. And I got one more.
Wait. Please, with survivability, okay. It's something missed. That is a major part of modernization.
It is.
Major. And people miss that. Yes. They just think we're building new ones. No. We're making them stronger, better, faster, and more survivable.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, I would argue that they're also more survivable in the acquisition process, right? I can get parts for them.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And then finally, it's the clarity of the deterrence message, right? Deterrence must be seen, exercised, and communicated consistently and persistently. Those words are different. They mean things. So again, the five issues of credibility, as we have an academic moment with our audience: reputation, investment, readiness, survivability, and clarity. You can find that on page 25 of the NPR. And I think you put those things together and you build a plan that reacts to the situation of which we have designed the NPR to deal with problems of what we call the near term and the long term. And so in the near term, we deal with a lot of what the ambassador calls for, uploading the Minuteman III systems, putting bombers back on alert, renukifying, I'm making up a word here,
wow.
Renukifying the bombers, if you can do that, and as practical, right? STRATCOM has to have the real desire in here, but it's the president and the NPR that says, this is something we value, this is something that has to happen. The STRATCOM is not going to do anything that the president doesn't, you know, order to be done, so to speak.
Right.
As long as it's lawful, they're going to move accordingly. And so we have to have a strategy. We can't just limp along here and say, well, if we can extend this treaty another year with a handshake with a despot that we don't trust and call a war criminal, and if we can just sort of pretend like we don't have to build more submarines, and we'll admire this problem a little bit longer in the hopes that maybe the Chinese won't actually invade Taiwan or any of the other kinds of things that we're sort of hedging with a big H. Against, right? Deterring. We're trying to deter and shape the world so that we can buy peace, build peace, maintain peace. And if you connect it to the president's national security strategy that just came out in December of 2025, you will see he calls for the creation and maintenance of a robust strong nuclear arsenal. He connects how deterrence it fuses together the economic opportunities that is the president's goal, the revitalization and reindustrialization of America, and how that connects into Golden Dome, which is another project, of course.
Well, they fit all together. That's the piece, right?
Everything fits together.
Yes.
And none of them work well without, I think, is the first piece, and that is a strong nuclear deterrent. One that is out there, in your face, that is vibrant. And it has to be. One of the things that the Ambassador Marshall Billingsley noted is that he was not in favor of what he called friendly proliferation, which was sort of the allowing of allies to garner their own nuclear weapons.
I call it participation, and, by the way.
We call it nuclear participation. We do not espouse that in this NPR, by the way. But what I will say is if you have a goal as a government to ensure that other nations don't proliferate, I'm sorry, that your allies don't proliferate friendly or participate friendly, however you want to couch it, right? They don't become their own nuclear powers in and of themselves. If you don't want them to give up on our assurance of our extended deterrence, then we must have an arsenal that is big enough, credible enough, and powerful enough for them to feel comfortable and confident in that arsenal to say, I am willing to risk Berlin for Boston. I am willing to risk Omaha for Oslo. You've got to convince them. And the best way to do that is to buy, build, and sustain a robust number, one that is not just that is not just enough, right? It has to be robust.
Yeah, no, and I'm going to borrow from your words again. It has to be consistent. It has to be done persistently. And we have to show them that that's happening. And I think we, like I said, our eyes were off the ball for a good period of time. That doesn't build confidence for us now and in the future. So this has to be, you know, when we look at this NPR and you know, I started out this conversation in part one, and I even brought it out in part two, that this is not just a NPR for today, but really we have to be consistent and persistent through the future. As long as our adversaries are dynamic in what they're doing, we have to be dynamic in the way that we approach it. And so it's a time for a new view. And so I think we lay that out there. I think it was very well done.
Before we close out, I want to make one last observation.
No. Go ahead.
All right. Again, you go back to that testimony on the 10th of December. The senator, I believe it was Senator Sheehan from Sheehy from New Hampshire, asked a very good question. She said, she asked Dr. Gottmuller and Ambassador Billingsley, were they aware that if the Trump administration was working on a new NPR, a nuclear posture review? Because all through his testimony and his answers, Ambassador Billingsley kept referring to, well, when we get the new NPR, we can use it to inform. One of the things he was talking about it was necessary to inform negotiations in the future, that the new NPR was needed to inform negotiators about what they could and, you know, how to move forward in any negotiations, which is something I had not thought of, Jim, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting is both witnesses said they were not aware of a nuclear posture review under draft, my words, not theirs, currently under the Trump administration, of which the senators seemed to take issue with. They were not happy about that. They indicated, at least from my watching of the testimony, that they didn't believe one was being written either. We know that there are several folks out there. Frank Miller and Madeline Creedon have both wrote together an article last summer that said we don't need another NPR, just move forward with what we have. And this was a major motivator, I think, for why we wrote this NPR, because we believe you need an NPR. And apparently Ambassador Billingsley agrees, and another something we did not know. So as the NPR, if whether there's an NPR under draft in the Pentagon or not, I have no idea. But I will tell you that if there are people in the hallowed of the halls of the Puzzle Palace and in Arlington, Virginia, I would say start with ours.
Saves you some
time.
We've
done some work for you. You're free to borrow any of the language that we have there, and let's see if we can at least get the new NPR a little closer to one of consequence rather than one of sufficiency.
Yeah, very good. No, thank you. And again, I want to remind our viewers and our listeners that the views of the hosts and the guests on the show are our own, but we think but it comes from a lot of experience and a lot of thought. And I put that back to say, that's what we did with the NPR. And so when they said there was no quote, NPR being written, my answer would be, yeah, there was, it was proposed. Just read it, take what you want. And hopefully it maintains its strength, because I think water this down would not be good, because we see it as an opportunity for the administration to get it right and set a course for the United States in nuclear work that has not been done for quite some time.
That's right. So in the end, Jim, you have only one chance to deter an attack. And if you fail to deter that attack, you've been attacked.
Yeah.
And you're at war.
Yeah.
So you've got to get it right the first time.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Well, this is the end of this part two. If you hadn't listened to part one, go back and listen to it, because the two go together fairly well. And if you haven't read the Nuclear Posture Review, Peace Through Strength, Renewing America's Nuclear Deterrent, it can be found at thinkdeterrence.com. Look for our research insights and go there and look at all the other things. We've talked about this many times, but look at all the material we put out in podcasts and seminars and writings and opinions. And I think I've caught everything for now. And in 2026, who knows, we may be expanding that list of things that we are doing. We do quite a bit here in education, et cetera. But come out and visit us. If you have questions or comments, send them to us at nids@thinkdeterrence.com. We appreciate all you're going to do with us in 2026. We are a 501c3 organization. We certainly can use donations to keep this podcast rolling, to keep us moving along. And if you're interested in becoming a part of us, let me know. And so at this time in 2026, I just want to remind you to think deterrence.
Happy New Year, all.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrent Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.